The first primary results of the 2020 presidential race are in. Joe Biden goes after Pete Buttigieg. Plus, Indiana's syringe exchanges under threat of elimination and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending February 14th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the Democratic presidential nomination picture really didn't become much clearer after the first primary of the campaign. New Hampshire went for Senator Bernie Sanders. As in Iowa, Sanders and former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg were the top two. While Sanders collected about 4,000 more votes, he and Buttigieg earned the same number of delegates from the Granite State. The surprise of the night was Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, who rode an impressive debate performance into a strong third-place finish in New Hampshire. The first-in-the-nation primary also cleared the Democratic field a bit, as entrepreneur Andrew Yang, Colorado Senator Michael Bennett, and former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick ended their bids. Did New Hampshire's results answer any questions about the race? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, what's your takeaway from New Hampshire?
Well, I mean, obviously, Iowa was not a fluke for Pete Buttigieg. I mean, he certainly closed the gap. Everyone expected Bernie Sanders to carry New Hampshire, but not by the margin he carried it. I mean, Pete Buttigieg was right in there and shows he is a serious factor, a serious contender for the nomination, and frankly, that Bernie's star is on the wane. Because when he ran in 2006, and I know it was only a two-person primary, but he had an overwhelming majority in that race. And this time it was, what, somewhere around 2 percentage points. And the division of the delegates is roughly even. So Pete is a force to be contended with, and that's pretty clear after New Hampshire.
What's your takeaway?
Well, clearly Pete Buttigieg is a force to be reckoned with here. That's been the case since he outraised everybody, right, and you know, coming into this, or for a period of time did. Bernie Sanders' ability to maintain himself at the front of this pack, I think you could argue, really created, and you could feel it this week, an opportunity for Michael Bloomberg. There was a lot more attention around Michael Bloomberg now that he's spent $250 million on television. He's obviously made, you know, gotten ballot access in Indiana and other states, and that's been a focus. So from a ground game standpoint, he's really beefed that up. And I think it's because these top five, and I do like Mayor Pete, and the job he's done in the campaign, the type of campaign he's run, but Joe Biden falling off and just looking lost in this race is what it was. My biggest takeaway from New Hampshire, which has, I think, created the sense that even the top tier candidates are not ready for this, and which is by some segment of the Democratic primary vote electorate, which I think has given this opportunity to Michael Bloomberg.
I want to talk a little bit about the other side for a second, which was Donald Trump didn't really have much of a primary challenge here in New Hampshire, but he got way more people decided to cast a ballot for him than they had for any incumbent of either party, I think, ever, certainly in a very long time. So does that send a bit of a message, too, about how he's still got, I mean, yes, there's a lot going on with Donald Trump, but there's still a really sizable...
Well, he's rallying, too, leading up to the election.
I think you can say that he continues to be surprisingly popular, at least surprisingly if the measuring tools are traditional American politics and the sort of conventional wisdom of what constitutes a good president or a successful president. He is packing his rallies. He is hauling in votes there at the ballot box.
He is interfering in prosecutions.
If anything, I mean, we talked about this on the show before. You know, did the whole impeachment debate or a trial help him? And it seems, anecdotally at least, that it did.
Sure, because now he thinks he has a carte blanche to do anything he wants.
And at the very least, it didn't hurt him.
Right, right.
There's a lot of the sort of punditry around New Hampshire and Iowa now is that, yes, Pete is doing better than a lot of people expected him to do, but we know that he has struggled with people of color, getting people of color to back him. We are now going to start seeing states where there are significant minority populations. So is it really
He's done better, yes, but now it's put up or shut up time for Pete Buttigieg.
Oh, yeah. He has to have a decent showing in South Carolina, or it's going to completely halt his momentum, I think, because that's such a large base for Democrats that if he cannot make inroads after, you know, however many months he's been at this, that's a problem for the candidate.
So, I mean, if he finishes in the top three in South Carolina, that's
certainly
momentum.
I would say top two, maybe. But.
And I think top three is good enough, and don't even forget that Nevada comes first.
Yeah, but the way with candidates dropping from by the wayside as quickly as they are, being in the top three isn't.
Go
it may not be.
I don't think we're going to lose any candidates. I mean, more candidates.
You know,
time.
But yeah. I mean, this before clearly, if anything this past week did, it's not about what volunteer steps forward. It's basically the old, you know, scene where who steps back and leaves those other people standing, because we did see quite a few, you know, the trapdoor
coming out of February. Though,
nobody knew they were in the race.
Coming out of February, you do need a couple pops, and even though he won Iowa, nobody noticed
because the story was
a disaster, right?
People
then,
noticed
the days later. They said, "Oh,
he
barely won."
He does well in Nevada. That's your second pop.
That's true. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, which we will be asking again, who will be the Democratic nominee for president in 2020? Joe Biden, Mike Bloomberg, Pete Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, or someone else, with apologies to Amy Klobuchar, I suppose. Last week's question, who will win the 2020 Indiana governor's race? 75% of you say Eric Holcomb. 24% say Woody Myers, and 1% say a Libertarian candidate. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, speaking briefly of Joe Biden, who finished fourth and fifth, respectively, in Iowa and New Hampshire, he took aim at Pete Buttigieg in a new campaign ad this week. The Biden campaign, facing questions about the strength of a former VP's candidacy, released an ad that seeks to contrast Biden's experience with Buttigieg's. And the ad isn't subtle about it.
Joe Biden helped save the auto industry, which revitalized the economy of the Midwest, and led the passage and implementation of the Recovery Act, saving our economy from a depression. Pete Buttigieg revitalized the sidewalks of downtown South Bend by laying out decorative brick.
In response, the Buttigieg campaign called the attack a, quote, classic Washington style of politics, and said the ad speaks more to where Biden stands in the race. Mike O'Brien, does this come off as desperation from the Biden campaign?
I suppose everything comes off as desperation when you're in the position that Joe Biden's in. Look, I mean, to me, the crack about the sidewalks came off as so small. It was just so small-minded and immature. From a former vice president who's supposed to be like the party's standard bearer here and owning this primary season, which he's clearly not. He is cratering, and it's not happening slowly. And so I understand and they clearly recognize that based on the tactics they're using, right? And they're going after the top people. They know that Pete Buttigieg has put himself in a position to appeal to the moderates in the Democratic primary, and he's got to start peeling them off, or he's done.
We saw Amy Klobuchar go hard after Pete Buttigieg. She has for a while, but particularly in that debate last week before the New Hampshire primary, we saw Amy Klobuchar go really hard after Pete Buttigieg. But it didn't read like this from Joe Biden.
Well, as Mike says, he's the former vice president of the United States and former senator. Okay, and frankly, he has done a lot for the country, and he has done a lot for the party. But he's passed his sell-by date. And he needs to step down and get out of the way because he isn't going to gather that momentum. The fact that his son did what his son did has hurt him. And, you know, although that's not Joe's fault, and certainly we can't all be held to task, as you will find when your children get older, you can't be responsible for everything that they do.
When your vice president pulling the strings.
Nonetheless, it's time for him to go back and rest on his laurels and get on the speaking tour and write a book, but not run for president.
Apart from how it seemed a little petty, these particular attacks seemed not so much like they were going after Pete Buttigieg, but almost like, well, if you're a mayor, who cares what you write?
Who cares about
a little risk of
that.
I mean, obviously, there are different scales of being the, you know, vice president of the United States versus a mayor. But, you know,
mayor's tougher.
Exactly, because you're running into everyone at the
and
store.
People are getting a lot more from
their mayor. About your stupid right. sidewalks, that's for sure. So, I mean, but yeah, it did seem a little petty. I mean, he could have just pointed out, you know, his accomplishments, but no, he had to go the other way.
Let me ask this question, which is everybody, the expectation is for Joe Biden to do so well in South Carolina because he's historically strong with the black community. That's a major part of that vote. And so there's sort of an expectation that, oh, South Carolina will help revive Joe Biden. Will it matter at this point?
Well, he's in a horrible position right now. And the thing about primary season, it's so much about expectations. It's not always just about what the numbers actually say. So you're right. Even if he comes away with a win, when is a win not a win? Well, it's when if somebody else is you know, nipping at his heels, or it shows that perhaps Pete Buttigieg, surprise, surprise, has made inroads, according to exit polls and so forth, with minorities, and may be more electable than we have given him credit for.
You could argue the only real win for Joe Biden would be if he wins South Carolina by, like, 20 points. Yeah.
100%.
Like, if he doubles up on people, maybe. But that just doesn't seem likely at this point.
Well, and again, that's part of it. And then he's a historically bad fundraiser anyway. Yeah. Always has been, all the way back to his days running for U.S. Senate. I don't think he likes it. I don't think he's good at it. And unless he gets a huge bump here,
and that doesn't
the numbers, there are two games taking place, you know, the perception game in terms of voters and delegates, and then the money. I mean, they're sort of interwoven, but either one could torpedo them.
Yeah. Well, Indiana House leaders say they'll try to extend at least by 1 year local syringe exchange programs that are set to expire in 2021. The programs are in danger of elimination after the Senate recently rejected an effort to extend them indefinitely. Scott County, Indiana, was undergoing an HIV epidemic in 2015. Lawmakers responded by allowing the creation of a syringe exchange program, something 8 other counties have also since implemented. And House Speaker Brian Bosma says those programs have been a success.
The CDC and others have cited that as one of the reasons that we were able to stem the tide.
But the original legislation also eliminated the programs in state law in 2019, later extending it to July 2021. And when asked this session to extend the programs permanently, 27 Senate Republicans said no. Republican Representative Ed Clear led the charge to create syringe exchanges. He says now he's just hoping to keep them alive at least a little longer.
I think that may be the best move at this point. Is to work on a compromise to try to extend the sunset by 1 year rather than repealing it altogether.
Clear points out 82% of syringes given out by the programs were returned. Nikki Kelly, you listened. You were sitting right next to me when we listened to the Senate debate on syringe exchanges. Did that chamber sound ready to extend them at all?
I mean, there were a few people who did.
It was 27-22.
It was. It was very split. But I think the main issue is that half of the Senate is gauging the success of that program based on whether we're halting drug addiction, and the other half is gauging it on what the program is actually supposed to do, which is stop the spread of disease. And in that sense, it's unequivocally a success. It has definitely done that. I think it's fair for them to discuss whether we can add some wraparound services in to try to, you know, come more directly at them with how they can get help with their addictions. But this whole visual of people finding the needles in the parks seems to be one they bring up all the time. And until they can get past that, maybe a one-year extension, we'll see.
I asked Representative Clear this question, which was, does there need to be a better sales job done with some lawmakers, like Nikki just mentioned, who seem to have a misperception of what these programs are supposed to do? And he was a little frustrated because he feels like he's been making that same sales pitch for all 5 years that these programs have been around now. But is that just what needs to happen again?
If you were a political ad agency, that wouldn't be the ideal client. I mean, it's not as if you're rolling out some, you know, scene of a idyllic farm setting with mom and dad and the kids out playing around or going to the parade. I mean, you're dealing with people who are struggling with some of our most intractable problems, both economically, in terms of health, in terms of the intersection of so many of these challenges that people face in our state. It's not exactly, you know, hey, come rally around these people, because they're seen in some ways by some people as either having flawed characters or a lack of will or a lack of judgment or a lack of morals, fill in the blank. So I'm not sure what that ad campaign would look like. other than to say maybe if in the long term it's probably cheaper to go this route, yeah. Even if, let's put morals aside, I mean, you're going to pay in the end, with you being taxpayers, and there's tremendous cost associated with this disease and the spread of this disease. Probably better to control it than to battle it and try to maintain it once it's basically manifested as full-blown disease.
Now, what the House leadership is talking about is a one-year extension to just give a little breathing space. And Speaker Bosman acknowledged that even if they don't get anything done this session, they don't end until July of 2021. So we do have some time here. But can we afford to cut ourselves that close to the deadline to keep these programs around?
I think ultimately they'll extend it for a year. They can't extend it indefinitely. One, there's no political support for it, and procedurally they can't bring that proposal back since
right.
it was
not
defeated,
session,
right? But I think Nikki hit it right on the head. I mean, it's nonsensical to particularly conservative lawmakers that having a syringe exchange program is going to get somebody off drugs, and that isn't the point. But it's always been talked about in a clumsy way, and that's not Ed Clear's fault, certainly. He's one of the biggest advocates, but the way it's sold by other lawmakers or opposed by other lawmakers is always in that basis, and it's nuanced, but they get it wrong. The whole point of the program is to curb a public health crisis, not to get people off of drugs. Now, we are getting people off of opiates because they're either dying or we've seen a fourfold increase in the use of meth, right? So we're not doing anything about it, or we are. We're doing a lot of things, actually, about drug addiction, but it's a moving target, and this is intentionally very, very targeted and specific on the public health side. Then we have to do other things on the drug addiction side to reduce that. It's not this, but it's constantly confused.
Nikki brought up something. In the Senate debate, this is one moment that struck me. Senator Chris Garton got up, who's from Charlestown, and said what a success the syringe exchange program was in his area. He has sat with families. He has seen the impact that this has made in their lives to stop the spread of this disease.
But
there's not enough wraparound services. I'm voting against extending these programs.
So the perfect.
Who controls the wraparound?
They control the wraparound services. The problem with this is it has been a success. Okay, it's done exactly what it was supposed to do, and Republicans don't think that government should do anything successfully, so they need the candidate. That's what's going on here. It's pretty simple.
Well, ultimately, it shouldn't be. You can make the case it shouldn't be permanently extended because it is targeted, and maybe we do need to think about that. And certainly, a couple years ago, Governor Holcomb pushed legislation that allowed locals to make these decisions.
Yes.
Right, so they increase the speed with which they can adopt a program like this in a public health crisis,
but yeah, less involved
having the debate
the state,
about yeah, having the debate in a more comprehensive way on drug use and what drugs are being used and how do we curb these public health crises, that should be a constant conversation.
But also, they're getting more data, but they're also, these syringe exchanges are allowing us to get more data about some
right.
of this stuff than we've
right.
ever
but,
had
but
before.
If you're going to offer the wraparound services, that requires you to expend money.
Hey, the drug crisis is the forefront, but we've been dealing with this as a state and as a nation in terms of public policy for decades. Condoms distributions in schools, you know, do you want to prevent disease? Do you want to ward off unwanted pregnancy?
I mean, this is entirely dissimilar. Yeah.
No, I mean it's. But people say that. Oh, that's just an invitation to. You know, people might not have been thinking about having sex until that condom.
I saw that condom
for the first time.
These are issues that are. I don't know what the next one will be yet. We haven't figured it out, but I'm sure we'll still wrestle with this in years to come.
All right. Well, an investigation by the Indiana State Board of Accounts says the quest to maximize profit. Two virtual charter schools led leaders to inappropriately collect more than $68 million in taxes. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle has more.
The report found staff at Indiana Virtual School and Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy enrolled thousands of students who never took a course and some who didn't even know they were enrolled. Counting these extra students led the schools to collect tens of millions of dollars in state funding over the years. Much of the revenue is passed on to multiple companies linked to school officials and their family members. House Speaker Brian Bosma says it all sounds criminal, and he asks if the State Department of Education should have found that problem sooner.
Clearly did not in this situation, and I think there'll be a lot of questions asked about that as well.
Ed Delaney, an Indianapolis representative and Democrat, says he's warned Republicans that virtual charter schools need more legislative oversight.
That threat has come home and has hit the taxpayers in the wallet.
Both schools were closed last summer after their charters were revoked.
John Schwanes, do questions need to be asked about legislative oversight?
Well, in a way, people have been asking those questions now for years because this is not the first hint of controversy surrounding a school that has has been overzealous in its attempts to collect fees for
that
its,
is
its
one way to put it.
Its
yes.
education, supposed education of Hoosier students. This is an ongoing challenge, and lots of people, including this, I think that guy's named Ed Delaney. You may have heard of him at some point
I
in the
think I've run across
in the that. In the video there, has been saying for a long time, and others, that if schools get public dollars, whether they, are chartered as this,
or
brand X or Y or Z, they still need to adhere to the same standards that, in terms of transparency and accountability, that would be applied to any traditional public school. And so I think that probably seems to be maybe an overly simplistic solution, but or at least has proven elusive to try to do that. But treating everybody the same would probably be the logical approach here.
Brian Bosma was very ready to blame everyone. The virtual charters themselves, obviously. Daleville, which authorized it. The Department of Education, which he felt didn't exert enough oversight authority, but seemed unwilling to say that the legislature really has any more role to play here.
Part of it is it went on a couple of years. Now, last year they did pass some additional oversight. I'm just confused. Like, colleges do online courses, and somehow you take the test, you get the grade, and it's fine. I don't understand what we're missing, why we can't translate that down. And I've heard a few people suggest, maybe on the virtual side at least, we should pay them in arrears. Kids earn this amount of credits, you get paid.
What is the solution then?
It is easy to do. They just don't want to do it. If you put reform after any silver bullet they're looking for as a way to attack public education, they get all the money they want. And it's not a coincidence that when we're talking about lack of legislative oversight, these groups and their subsidiaries gave money to the Republican caucus and to Brian Bosma. Okay? Now, shocking as that may be, then they don't put any oversight in this. And it is unconscionable. We're not just talking about the $68 million where they didn't educate these kids. What happened to these kids? Did they go to traditional schools? Did they drop out?
I think a lot of these kids are what we would traditionally call a dropout, right?
Yes.
And they would have counted in the dropout rate.
Okay, so they're
but
not
instead,
getting an education.
They're signing them up for online school so that they're not counting them.
We're not even talking about the other $88 million that went from the charters from the virtual schools to their related, their mothers, their fathers, their cousins, their brothers.
Let me ask
companies.
This: Ed Delaney, when talking with reporters this week about this issue, said that he's been telling his Republican colleagues that the virtual charters are going to tear down the regular charter system. That he thinks that people are going to paint with a broad brush. Now, I'm not sure he's opposed to that, but he thinks Republicans certainly are. So is he right? Is there an element to which they have to really crack down on the virtual side or they're going to start unraveling?
Oh, yeah. He's absolutely right. And that was my problem with this entire situation, that it gives Ann Delaney, people like Ann Delaney, the opportunity to see, I told you so, on these charters, they can't be trusted. We've got to invest all that money back in traditional K-12 public education.
All right. Well, legislation to require all Hoosier High School students complete a federal financial aid form hit a speed bump in the House this week.
The state estimates only 58% of Indiana's 2019 high school graduates completed the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA. That's below the national average. A bill this session would make completion of the form mandatory unless parents opted out. Business groups say it will help improve the pipeline into the workforce and help ensure Hoosier families don't miss out on opportunities. But some school groups don't like it. The Indiana Association of School Principals, for instance, argues the bill piles a further burden onto school counselors, and some House GOP lawmakers balked at the idea of a mandate.
I don't think this is a particularly partisan question, Mike O'Brien. Should this be a mandate?
I'll try to make it one.
Okay.
I think the problem with the mandate is it presumes the other 42% had no idea, and they didn't make an intentional decision to not pursue financial aid. It's a completely rational thought today to leave high school and say, I'm not going to go $100,000 in debt. I have interests elsewhere. Yeah. So I think it's a little presumptuous that 100% of students should do this, and the ones who haven't didn't do it.
You need to guess.
Well, yeah, but there's somewhere between the 58% and 100% that we're missing.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, I think Teresa Lubbers had this in her state address. I think it's a good idea. The problem is we've already overworked the counselors and underpaid them, and you're going to have to put resources there so they can run those education programs.
Nikki, there was also a question about, like, this is some private information that necessarily.
I've had to fill that form out for my daughter, and you're putting down a lot of very key financial data,
and they're not easy to do. Either.
No, they're very hard to do, and so there is a question about should someone have to do it? Especially there are parents who you know just by looking, like my kid is not, you know, going to qualify. So why do I have to spend 3 hours figuring all this out?
Something
and
else?
Then sending all my personal data to the federal government.
I think that the bill will probably end up passing at the end of the
Probably.
Day. Yeah. All right. Well, that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. We hope you all have a very happy Valentine's Day, and if my tie today was your first reminder of that, you should probably pick something up before you get home.
Maybe another tie.
If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.